AP13CR, 11AP814, State versus Juan Gracia, and the City of Menasha versus Juan Gracia. Counsel for Mr. Garcia, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is John Holyvote. I represent Juan Gracia in these matters. We are before the court today on two different and distinct issues, the first of which is whether or not the entry into Mr. Gracia's bedroom was lawful because of the community, it was exercised under the community caretaker exception to the Fourth Amendment. This court has already done a good deal of work on this issue in trying to fine-tune what the standard is for the community caretaker exception to apply. We need to find an objectively reasonable basis to believe there was a community caretaker function. In short, when an officer finds a member of the public in need of assistance, the community caretaker exception can apply. In this case, there was no objectively reasonable basis for the community caretaker function, and there was no indication that someone was in need at the time when the officers entered Mr. Gracia's bedroom, which is the significant event in this case as it relates to the Fourth Amendment. There had certainly been an auto accident, no one disputes that, although the vehicle was drivable, and the driver of that vehicle was able to maneuver it safely from where the accident occurred to his home. There were no indications that there had been injuries, either at the accident scene nor from the officer's inspection of the vehicle. There wasn't blood in the vehicle. There wasn't blood trail leading from the vehicle to his home. And most significantly in this case, once the officers enter Mr. Gracia's home, and they do so with permission of his co-tenant and brother, Jaime Gracia, they find Mr. Gracia awake and responsive on the other side of a locked bedroom door. He tells the officers and his brother to go away. He has a conversation with his brother in both English and Spanish. He's quite clear that he doesn't want the officers there and that he is not in need of their assistance. For that reason, at that point, there is no longer any objective reasonable basis to believe there was a community caretaker function that the officers needed to perform. And so at that point, they had no legitimate reason to remain, let alone to enter his bedroom after his brother Jaime had breached the doorway.
Do you think it makes any difference that his brother was the one who broke down the door and it was not at the insistence of law enforcement?
I think it makes a difference in the sense that we're not dealing with an agency problem, but short of that, I think really not at all. We have Mr. Gracia in his personal bedroom in a shared dwelling. We have case law that is clear that a co-tenant can certainly refuse permission after one's already granted it, and that therefore anything they might find as it relates to Mr. Gracia couldn't be used against him. We also, I don't think, have sort of a muddled area of the house. We're not talking about Mr. Gracia being in the living room or the kitchen. He's in his private bedroom that he exercises exclusive control over, and he's done that already by locking the door. So, no, I don't think that makes a significant difference.
Does the record reflect at all what the officers observed when the door opened?
That's an interesting question, Justice Engler. I'd say that the record's actually pretty silent on that. Eventually, the officers do see some indicia of intoxication, and they do then perform and complete their OWI investigation at that point. But prior to entering the bedroom, they do not observe that. There's no testimony in the record that as they hear Mr. Gracia speaking to his brother that his speech is slurred or that he's incoherent. Again, part of that conversation leads that his brother is in a language that the officers don't understand. But there's no indication prior to entering the bedroom. All the evidence they need to further their OWI investigation occurs after they cross the threshold and speak with Mr. Gracia at his bedside.
Thank you.
So this is a very time-specific and place-specific issue, as I hear you present it. You don't object to their entering the house, do you?
I don't. I believe they could do that lawfully with Mr. Jaime Gracia's permission.
Well, they're both sharing the house, so I don't know whether one person's permission is enough, but that's not what you're objecting to.
It is not, and I think for Mr. Gracia to deny permission, he would have had to have been at the threshold. I think that's what Georgia V. Randolph says to us, is that since he was absent the threshold and absent during that conversation, to keep them out of the house altogether, he would have needed to be at the door.
Okay.
But certainly he is present at the threshold to his bedroom.
Okay. So now we're going to go upstairs, and we're at the threshold of the bedroom. And the law enforcement does not ask, I assume, the brother to kick in the door.
They do not. That's not the record. I think, in fact, they're as surprised as anyone.
Okay.
Was this upstairs?
Pardon me?
Was it upstairs? I just don't remember that in the record. I thought it was a trailer home.
It's a single.
Sorry. Okay. Doesn't matter whether it's upstairs or not, right?
It is a trailer home. That's correct.
I always visualize that what happens to the defendant can happen to anyone. My bedroom's upstairs. Because the Fourth Amendment protects us all, right? So we're at the bedroom door, and the kick-in of the door, that's not something that you're attributing to the law enforcement.
No, I don't think anything in the record suggests that.
So you think that any caretaker function is destroyed at the threshold of the bedroom door when the defendant appears to be safe and says, go away?
I would say that any basis for the community caretaker is at best sketchy from the outset. But I would say once they have made contact with him and he's responsive and declining assistance, then certainly it's gone. And
I'm sorry, you continue.
I would say I think that really sets this case aside from all of our other community caretaker cases that relate to home entry. We don't have in any of those cases an awake and responsive defendant.
So he says go away, but they don't, right?
They do not. In fact, they try the door.
They what?
They try the door.
Okay. And go in.
Well, they try the door and it's locked. And then Mr. Gracia's brother, Jaime, breaches the door, and then they enter.
Then they go into the room. He says, go away.
Well, he had previously said, go away. There's nothing on the record that says he's continuing that. He says it numerous times before they enter.
He said it before the entrance. They don't. And then they pick up evidence of his inebriation.
That's correct.
And so you think that evidence should be suppressed because they're in the wrong place without a warrant?
I would agree with that, Chief Justice. I think at that point, the only reasonable explanation, the only possible explanation, and no doubt it's why the state has chosen to make that the basis of their defense of the police officer's actions, is community caretaker. And I don't think that could have applied then.
What was the purpose, in your view, for the police crossing the threshold of the defendant's room?
I think their intent had always been to investigate the accident and to investigate a possible OWI. Now, obviously, subjective intent's not dispositive, but I think their subjective intent actually was criminal investigation. Their testimony was contrary to that, but I think their actions speak to it. They never inquire as to Mr. Gracia's well-being prior to the door being breached, after the door being breached. There's no indication that they ever seek to ascertain whether he's injured, he needs assistance, at any point during their contact.
Why do you think Jaime broke the door down if he thought his brother was just fine? I mean, it sure does seem like you have a pole that's down, you have paint on the car, you have the officers investigating the scene of this accident, they trace it back to this residence and this person who drives this car. And, you know, it's a significant accident. It's not just a wooden post or something. I mean, it's a traffic pole. They're at the residence. They're about to leave. Jaime comes home. They explain what they're investigating. They're worried that the brother's hurt. He goes in the house. They don't go in until they're invited in, as I understand it. And then they go to the door, and sure, the brother's saying, you know, go away or whatever, but Jaime, the brother of the defendant, decides it's important enough that he breaks down the bedroom door. Do you think that's any indication that Jaime thought his brother may be injured or hurt or needing help?
I think that's a possibility, and I think the Court of Appeals makes a good deal out of it, although I would say too much. As we already discussed, subjective intent of the officers, trained law enforcement officers, isn't dispositive. The Court of Appeals seems to make subjective intent of Mr. Gracia's brother dispositive in this case, at least in finding that there was a bona fide community caretaker activity going on. In this instance, I don't think we can really guess at what Jaime Gracia's motivations were. There's nothing in the record to suggest that it was concern for his brother. Certainly we have cases, and I've represented individuals, where their family members, brothers or otherwise, are the ones who are turning them in. Well, the case law that we have as it relates to co-tenants and their rights as it relates to the Fourth Amendment make it clear that sometimes you'll be co-tenants with people who do not have your best interests at heart. The only thing that we have in the record about what Jaime's possible motivations would be is sort of the shock displayed by Officer Lenz, and he talks about looking at the other officer who's with him in sort of disbelief. So if anything, the one person who testifies at the hearing and is there at the time that Jaime does this, his reaction to it is not, oh, look, Jaime must be so concerned about Mr. Gracia to have done this. It's just genuinely, we don't know why he's doing this, and we don't either, based upon the record that we have.
Well, what's the function of pretext here? You seem to think that this is not caretaker all. They didn't really go in to see if Mr. Gracia is okay. They're investigating an auto accident. The auto accident could have been due to drunk driving or drugs while driving, which would have been a crime. And so you make me think that this is pretextual, is it?
Again, I think their actions suggest that it was. Without them inquiring as to his welfare, why could they not have simply asked Jaime to check on his brother's welfare? I think Jaime's arrival on the scene actually, that by itself diminishes the need for officers to perform community caretaker function. We now have someone else on site who could look after his brother's welfare, who could inquire of his brother's welfare. They don't seek that from Jaime. They don't ever ask Mr. Gracia.
Well, what I'm really asking is sometimes pretext, manipulation, lying by police officers is perfectly okay and acceptable. Right? So you can have a pretextual traffic stop. No problem.
I would agree. Renz tells us as much.
No problem at all. You can have police officers in questioning a suspect make misstatements to encourage the suspect to confess. No problem.
Also true.
So you agree with that too?
Yes.
So my question is, in the caretaker function, is it the subjective view of the officers? Is it the objective view of the court, that is the court taking an objective view of the scene to determine whether or not the officers are engaging in caretaking?
I think it is an objective standard for the court to consider, and certainly I think what the officers are doing, either by their words or by their actions, can play a part in the court's decision. But ultimately, it is an objective test. And at that point, when he's declined assistance, what objective basis is there to believe that he has a need for assistance?
Was there probable cause when the police went into the house? Was there probable cause to arrest the defendant?
I would say no. First of all, we had nothing directly linking Mr. Gracia to driving the vehicle. His statements that he was the one driving come after the doors breached, after the officers enter. He then makes inculpatory statements to them. But in addition to that, we also have no direct link to him being intoxicated or having committed anything other than a civil hit-and-run violation.
What do you need probable? What kind of probable cause do you need to enter the house? Don't you need probable cause to believe a crime has been committed and the person has committed it?
I would say that that's correct, but again, I don't think they had that as it relates to Mr. Gracia, or really as it relates to anyone who might have been in the house, because again, they don't know that Mr. Gracia was the one operating the vehicle.
And, of course, even if you had probable cause, you'd still need a warrant for a house unless there were exigent circumstances. And here they might be somebody in trouble, that is, medical trouble.
That it was a possibility, at least for them, but I think, again, dispelled prior to them actually entering the bedroom.
But that's not the claim here, that there's probable cause to believe a crime and that there are exigent circumstances.
No, it is not. And the state's never made that argument that I'm aware of.
Counsel, let me, if, are you finished?
Just for caretaking, you don't need probable cause. I mean, you have to have a reason to believe that there's a person in trouble.
I think that's the only standard, is whether or not we believe that there's somebody who's in need of assistance or that harm would befall someone but for the police's actions.
Let me ask you this. Let's assume this isn't a pretext, that the officers indeed are concerned about the condition of the defendant. You're not objecting to the fact that they come to the house, that they enter the house, that they go to the bedroom door, but you're saying community caretaker ends as soon as that bedroom door is open. Do you have any case that supports that? The cases that I've looked at and that I remember are generally cases that center around whether or not the officers had a community caretaker function and therefore were acting legitimately in entering the house. Where does it stop? All of a sudden, there's no longer a community caretaker function?
I don't think that happens when the door is breached. I think it actually occurs when they have contact with Mr. Gracia, which is before that. When, let's say, hear that he's up and able to communicate and able to care for himself, or at least indicate whether or not he needs assistance. That's
they don't know he's up, do they?
He's awake and speaking with them.
Okay. That's what you're talking about with up. He's conscious.
He's conscious, and he seems to be able to carry on a conversation with his brother in addition. So I think he is at least aware of what's going on from at least what the officers would know at that point. And I think there are two different Fourth Amendment events here, the entry into the home and the entry into the bedroom. And I think they need to be examined separately. And we're looking at whether or not there was a valid community caretaker function at the time that they entered the bedroom, at the time of the second event for the purposes of the Fourth Amendment.
What case, if any, would you rely on for that proposition, that there's two different things we must look at here?
I don't know that there is a case that I would rely upon for that proposition. I do, however, think that if we're dealing with two different searches or two different seizures, the fact that there was at one time some fear that someone might have been injured, if that has been completely dispelled by the time that the second search or seizure occurs, I don't see how that exception could still justify it if it would otherwise be unlawful under the Fourth Amendment.
Could I ask, you want to suppress some evidence here?
That's correct.
You want to suppress what?
Anything that occurred subsequent to their entry into the bedroom. So that would include their observations of Mr. Gracia, his statements that he made to the officers at that time as well.
Okay. Could he be prosecuted for hitting the telephone pole?
I would say it would be possible, but difficult. Again, there's no statements that he was the driver prior to the entry, but they might be able to determine that from other people's statements, which is how they arrived at Mr. Gracia's home in the first place.
There's a pole down. There's a license plate there. They go to a vehicle. And there's only one person in that vehicle at the time they arrive. And there's only one person other than the brother ever found in that home. They have learned before they go to the home that it is Juan Gracia, who normally drives that vehicle. That's not probable cause?
I think, again, is a prosecution possible? I think it is. Do I think it's as strong as if the subsequent statements are let in? I don't. But certainly as it relates to the hit and run, I think they could proceed with a prosecution on that,
okay,
regardless of what's decided here.
Could they arrest him in the house?
I would say no without a warrant. I don't think that they could have entered it. I don't think they had probable cause of a crime as it relates to Juan Gracia at the time that they entered the home or that they entered the bedroom.
Is hit and run the only possible offense?
I don't spend too much time prosecuting Justice Prosser, but I would say that it's the one that strikes me automatically. I'm not sure if it's the only possibility. There's also civil penalties for leaving the scene of an accident, separate from the hit and run charge, but it is the one that strikes me, at least at first blush.
Was the arrest unlawful?
I would say yes, again, because their entry is unlawful. The arrest, are you thinking about after, assuming that the entry was lawful?
Can you separate the investigation, which I would label a search, from the arrest?
I would say it would be difficult. I think, again, if we find that the entry is unlawful, clearly the arrest that results from it is also unlawful. I would like to turn to the second issue, if I might, just because I see my yellow lights on.
Head counsel.
The second issue relates to Mr. Gracia's motion for a collateral attack. He's challenging the circuit court's ability to use his 1998 conviction for sentence enhancement purposes. I won't dwell long, particularly because I don't have much time, to talk about the classic factors, but we all agree that the issue here is with the second requirement of classic, which is whether or not he was aware of the difficulties and disadvantages of self-representation. There's no doubt that the colloquy doesn't address this issue. There's no doubt, or no dispute at least, between the parties that Mr. Gracia meets his threshold requirement of a prima facie showing. The burden then shifted to the state. The only question for this court is whether or not, based on what he said, he truly had an understanding of what the difficulties and disadvantages of self-representation were. I would argue he did not, in large part because he makes a very clear statement at that hearing that he has a fundamental misunderstanding of what the role of defense counsel would be. He states that he believes defense attorneys are only for the innocent. He did not realize that they could be of any benefit to someone who might have actually committed the charged offense. If we look at some different examples and guidance for what should be told to a defendant, we can look at the jury instruction, SM30, that goes through three or four paragraphs, depending on how you count it, of different requirements or at least suggestions to a circuit court judge of how they might address this issue. If we look at what Pickens tells us also about what this means, this idea that they need to know that presenting your defense is more than just telling a story, that you'll be held accountable for procedural rules. The jury instruction goes on to say that you would understand that an attorney might find defenses you're unaware of, or that they could mitigate the sentence in this case. Again, those specific suggestions for what a judge might tell them make it very clear that if a person's told them, they would realize that even people who might admit their guilt would benefit from defense counsel. The Deaver case, which I cite, I know it's unpublished, but it's from the Court of Appeals, I cited in my brief, reaches the conclusion that with absent a showing that the defendant's informed, that an attorney could provide possible defenses or find mitigating facts that would assist him or her, or independent knowledge of it, a valid waiver cannot be found. Again, I don't see that here. We do have Mr. Gracia has a basic understanding of what a lawyer is. He has a general idea of what the judicial system's about. He's watched television shows with lawyers in them. He has he was aware there was a thing called the O.J. Simpson trial. He and the rest of us who were alive when there was an O.J. Simpson trial. So, again, on that record, I don't think we have someone who really understands the difficulties and disadvantages of self-representation. I think the state actually gives Mr. Gracia and other members of the public too much credit, unfortunately, in this respect. When I attend social gatherings for the bar and I discuss what I do with transactional attorneys, I sometimes wonder if they fully grasp what my role is in the judicial system, let alone someone who finished high school, one semester of college, and works at a cheese factory. Again, it's not to denigrate the work that he does or him as a person, But one of the reasons we have these requirements is because people don't fully grasp what's going on. Again, they're not constitutionally mandated. They're part of the court's administrative powers. And for that reason, I actually would seek here from the court more guidance as to what is necessary to properly inform someone of what the difficulties and disadvantages of self-representation are. And that by itself would also help to explain what a defendant would have to know independent of being advised of that prior to there being a valid waiver found. I also think there's some concern perhaps that this opens the door for more collateral attacks. I don't think that's actually the case. First of all, there's been a great deal of effort to make colloquies more effective, but also we have waiver of counsel forms. I see my red lights on.
You can complete your sentence.
I would just say that both the forms that we have now as well as the new emphasis on a more complete colloquy actually would make this very limited application going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. David H. Perlman, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Perlman.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good afternoon, Justices. You should not begin an argument with an apology, but I must. I'm suffering from one of Wisconsin's multitude of viruses with unique symptomology. I can hear you perfectly well, but I have difficulty hearing myself. For a man who decidedly likes to hear himself speak, this is unfortunate.
You have a wonderful voice.
Well,
that informs you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So if there's any problem with pitch or resonance, I apologize.
But we can send you a tape and you can listen to it later.
To be my own self-critic.
Yes.
Thank you. I know my challenge today. I read the Pinkard decision handed down by this court in 2010 very carefully. And I would say that there was a cautious majority and a spirited dissent. And the vote was 4-3. So it is clear, in my view, that this court wants to make sure that there is not an abuse of the community caretaker doctrine and that all seven jurors share in that concern. I'm here to tell you today that Justice Bradley warned in Pinkard in her dissent that I am fearful that today's close call becomes tomorrow's norm, that this is not tomorrow's norm. This is a case in many ways that is as strong, if not stronger, than Pinkard. And in the most fundamental way, it is because in this case, and I think this was coming out in the Q&A between the justices and Gracia's counsel, we're asking the doctrine to do very little here. We're not asking the doctrine to storm into a house. We're not even asking the doctrine to justify a police warrantless intrusion into the bedroom. We're only asking the doctrine to support the police entering a bedroom that had already been breached by a concerned brother. Totality of circumstances is the test for the community caretaker, and I will concede that the circumstances before us are quite unusual. The most unusual is the intervention of the brother. How is this case stronger than Pinkard? In Pinkard, the injury was hypothetical. All we knew was a nexus between the subjects and drug use. Nobody knew of any injury or harm. Here we had a traffic accident so severe, it struck down a traffic pole, disengaged the license plate, and totally smashed the front end of Gracia's vehicle. Not much speculation to think that the person involved in that accident is not doing well. In Pinkard, they utilized the community caretaker justification to enter the home, the most sacrosanct of our Fourth Amendment protected areas. Here, we are not asking the community caretaker doctrine to do that. The home was entered through consent, consent lawfully given by the brother. In Pinkard, it was the armed drug task force that responded to the situation. Here we hit two officers acting from the very beginning when they received the dispatch consistently and persistently over their concerns that there was a major accident and that a person involved in it could be injured or in need of assistance. Gracia talks about pretext, but in these kind of facts, while I will readily concede that any police officer has an investigatory agenda when they do anything, and this court recognized that in Kramer, when they finally got rid of the Katie requirement, that you couldn't use the community caretaker doctrine unless you were completely divorced of an investigatory agenda. That was not a workable system. This court understood that, addressed it, and then Kramer said, we can have a bifurcated focus, but there's a difference between a bifurcated focus and a pretextual one. You have a severe injury. The officers, he says, in their manner indeed are acting consistent with attending to it. It takes them 45 minutes to get to the scene, but not because of any delay or any casual feeling on their part. They're investigating it. They go to one address. They go to another address. And finally, it leads them to the trailer home. When they get to the trailer home, and this is interesting to notice the police conduct, they don't see any evidence that somebody's inside, although they clearly, and this was Justice Proster brought this up in his question, they clearly saw the vehicle that was involved in the incident. The vehicle was missing the license plate, had the front end smashed, had the paint of the pole on it. That's more than probable cause. That, I would argue, is almost moving into guilt beyond a reasonable doubt area that that's the vehicle involved in this incident. But when they knock on the door and they don't get a response, they don't immediately use the community caretaker doctrine as a pretext to make a forcible entry into the home. Indeed, for a moment, the record's unsure of what their plan was, but they retreated. I would argue that's good police work. What to do next? Nobody's answering the door. Unlike the police in Ulch, which takes Pinker to its extreme and was rightfully shot down, they decided to look at the situation. The brother arrives, and here's where the things get different from our normal case, but still tell the circumstances. We take each case as it comes. Immediately, they don't ask the brother, nice day. They say, we're concerned for your brother. Look, is that his vehicle? Yes, that's his vehicle. And the vehicle smashed up. We can assume that the brother sees it the same way the officer does. He sees his brother was in a major traffic accident. The police ask for permission. He says, wait here. They don't suddenly say, no, we're not waiting, we're following you. They wait here. He comes back in 5 minutes and says, come on in. You can't have more responsible police work than this. The community caretaker doctrine is not being used as a ruse. They've entered through valid consent. Now, Georgia v. Randolph is inapplicable here because only one tenant was present at the threshold. They get to the bedroom.
Now, before we get to the bedroom, there's no question here that both entries are First Amendment searches.
Fourth Amendment searches,
fourth,
absolutely.
Excuse me, Fourth Amendment
yes,
searches.
Yes, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. I'm not going to argue that it's a continuum because the bedroom is locked and he's in it. And I think the first entry is into the home itself, which I argue is always the most dramatic entry, justified here under consent. I think all parties agreed that. I don't think Gracia's contending. He made some lip service to Georgia v. Randolph, but it's not applicable, and he admitted as much here in argument.
Counsel, earlier you made some maybe lip service in this case to hot pursuit. Is that at all an issue here, as I recall, maybe in the Court of Appeals it was?
Well, I would say that the state team made lip service to hot pursuit. Since I've taken over this case, I felt this was not a hot pursuit case, Your Honor. I felt
you don't have any exigent circumstances here.
Well,
you have to do caretaker.
I think there the exigency is within the community caretaker doctrine, concern about safety.
Right.
There was some mention of hot pursuit in the trial court's ruling, but I took over this case after the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals opinion does not mention hot pursuit, nor do I ask this court. I don't think it's a hot pursuit case. There's too much delay. There's too much time period. They were not chasing him.
You mentioned in your facts, and I know you're getting into the bedroom, but before you get into the bedroom...
I'll take my time before I enter the bedroom. This would look weird in the transcript, but it's okay here. That's why you need to be there to actually appreciate
it. Can you hear yourself? That's what I want to know.
Apparently I am hearing myself better than I thought.
There is some evidence that the law enforcement not finding initially anyone home, or at least they thought they were beginning to leave. Now, I'm not sure that's a correct characterization, but there's some assertion that that's what happened. How does that affect a community caretaker approach? If that fact is correct, it seems to me, are they giving up on community caretaker? And if so, how important is it really?
If that fact was correct, I think it would have a dramatic impact. The record is silent, and the brother's arrival was too quick for us to ascertain what their plan was. It was just as easy for me to infer, and the record is silent, that they were going to canvass an area, make a phone call, do other things. If they just merely went back to their station, yes, that would be a big factor. But that's not what occurred here. The brother arrived very shortly, and they maintained their concern with the brother. They asked about it right away, about the safety concerns of his brother. So now we get to the bedroom. And this is interesting. The bedroom, as we know, is the most protected area within the most protected area, the home. But we're already in the home. We get to the bedroom, and the brother and the officers, we assume, knock. The record's a little unclear. And he speaks in two languages, saying something to the effect of, go away, go away, go away. Well, we know from our own experience in real life that many injured people will say, go away, go away, go away. Doesn't necessarily mean there's no emergency. It's rather strange that he's yelling it. He didn't come to the door saying, everything's fine. He didn't say, no, I'm okay. He's saying, go away, go away. The officers now try to open the door. That's the only piece of police work in this entire case that I would, if I was judging it from afar, would say, I'm not sure about that play. Because right now we have a closed door. But they don't open the door. That's not before us. The brother, admittedly, without any provocation from the police, smashes the door down. Now, let's be realistic here. You're law enforcement. You felt that there was a crisis ongoing. You get to the bedroom door. They're screaming and yelling, and then a brother smashes the door open. This isn't the time. What are you supposed to do? Okay, that's good. I'm fine. They'll give me a call. There's something wrong with you? They're going to go in. They're going to follow that brother in. The breach has already occurred. They're concerned about his safety. They're going to go in. It's an unusual circumstance. At this point, I wouldn't know what's afoot. To paraphrase the debate of yesterday, there was tumult in the air. Lots of commotion. That was just...
Stay with the facts.
Yeah, but stay focused. But there was tumult. This was a dramatic thing. It doesn't happen often in police experience. The door smashes down. Now, one thing that Justice Prosser, I think, was hinting at, and as I sat here listening, I was thinking of myself, is the record, while it's not clear, there's very little contact, and immediately the police note he's highly intoxicated. Probably an observation they would have made even without entering, but that's speculative. They did go in right there. I'm arguing that that kind of intrusion, compared with everything that's occurred in this case, with their entire behavior, which consisted with the community caretaker doctrine, is normal, objectively reasonable, and subjectively reasonable. To expect them to suddenly walk away from that kind of scene and expect with a brother running in too, after that kind of a situation, I think is unrealistic. It would be a very difficult message to impart on law enforcement. The lessons for law enforcement appear to have been learned by these officers, that the home is very important, that we don't use the community caretaker to abuse that, that you seek consent when you can, and they did.
Mr. Perlman, would you concede that at least one of the motivations for going into the room was investigation, as your opposing counsel suggested?
Yes. And again, I'm guessing, but realistically, I would think certainly that would be in the air. But
okay.
As we've learned from this court in Kramer and disabusing that notion in Katie, but I will tell you one other thing about that. If I was a police officer, I would be thinking about sometimes defendants don't know what's their own good. And I think are quite capable, though severely injured, to try to avoid police contact, to avoid detection for an offense, which in my view should pale to the circumstance of having whatever injury you have addressed and attended to. If I'm a police officer, I'm not going to let the fact that I think there might be an OWI dissuade me that I also think there might be an injury.
Well,
so I'd say they had a bifurcated focus.
Okay. There is no blood in the car.
No.
There is no blood at the scene, I mean, between
no.
the car and the house. There's no detectable blood in the house.
Mm-hmm.
The brother is present. There's been a conversation in which the defendant says, go away. And then the door is open. They look inside. They see the defendant. Did they see any evidence that the defendant has been injured?
You know, and the counsel for Gracia can certainly correct me. The way the record seems to me, at that point, they just notice he's highly intoxicated right off the bat. So that's what
How do they notice that? Do they smell intoxicants?
he's talking. The record doesn't say, but I don't think if you're very highly intoxicated and you come into the presence of that, that's something that a trained police officer could quickly spot.
If you're lying in bed, I mean, I can see it if you're standing up, if you're trying to do something and you don't do it well, it's highly visible that you're intoxicated. Lying in bed, only in the nature of your responses or lack of any response.
Yeah, again, the record's a little silent on that. I think the more important point, though, is what was the officer's motivations at that particular time when they made that entry in there. And these facts are very unusual for any police officer. And I, again, without meaning to generalize, I think you could line up 1,000 officers, and 1,000 officers would think this is a situation I'm going to go in on after the door's been smashed open by the brother under these facts, under these circumstances. And again,
is the community caretaker test being applied when the threshold is crossed?
Well, I would say that, again, you're looking at the test is whether or not there's the degree of the public interest, the attendant circumstances surrounding the search. I think that, again, smash door adds to the dynamic.
A smashed door
by a brother adds to the dynamic. I think it was Justice Ziegler who opined or gleaned that a brother would largely be motivated for safety concerns as well. And if he's taking these dramatic recourses, that his smashing that door open kind of seals the deal.
Is that the only inference for the brothers?
I think it's a reasonable inference. I don't like to speculate or guess. It's a solid inference. It certainly goes beyond a speculative inference under these facts. He's seen the injury to the car. He knows his brother, we proceed. He's listened to his brother hollering to him, go away, go away. He lets the police in.
But after the brother has broken down the door, the officers see the defendant. They didn't see him covered with blood. They saw him in bed.
Well, all the record says is they saw him and that he was highly intoxicated. I don't know exactly. They entered, though. They entered. The record says they entered. After that, the record's pretty silent as to exactly what went on.
Well, now you say, and I guess you're right here, that the court has abandoned the totally divorced from test.
Yes, in Kramer.
Okay. So if we're trying to exercise the community caretaker function when a threshold is crossed, and part of the motivation is investigation, and part of the motivation is concern for the welfare of an individual, what is the result if it's 50-50?
Well, in Pinkard, I would argue where there was talk about a drug house where the police officers testified candidly that they were investigating a drug situation, that it was the drug task force that responded to the scene. It would seem that's a pretty heavy investigatory focus. Yet this court also found the community caretaker based on the fact that the door was slightly ajar, based on the fact they weren't responding to the knocks. So I couldn't put a percentage on it, but certainly I think rather than a percentage, it's the legitimacy of each concern. This court or any court, I don't think cottons or should cotton to a pretextual community caretaker. The chief aptly brought up times where pretext is legitimate.
So would you say that there can be a search anytime the police articulate a legitimate concern that is other than investigation?
Well, I think the police can articulate what they like, but it has to be objectively reasonable. It has to meet the three-pronged test. We're not going to let police just control the issue by always subjectively saying, I felt community caretaker. When I look at this case with these facts, though, I feel that the court had legitimate concerns in Pinkard that if we expand this doctrine too far, we could have a situation where in every case where there is a traffic accident, the police will feel that's a free ticket to enter a home under the community caretaker doctrine. But this court let enough breadcrumbs that were followed by the Court of Appeals in Ulsh to reject that concept. In Ulsh, where basically they made a warrantless entry in the home just because there was an accident, when even the person in the house said nobody was injured, other courts rejected that.
Once they open that door and he's in the bed and they immediately know he's intoxicated, hey, where's the caretaking now? Well, why don't they just say, so long, we're going to get a warrant for you because
you're driving drunk.
Pardon me?
I don't think they need to get a warrant to arrest them under those circumstances, no.
Why?
Well, because they're already in the position there they are. They're making their observation. The law allows for arrests to be made under those circumstances. At that point, they would have probable cause plus exigent circumstance. The exigent circumstance being alcohol dissipates quickly in the bloodstream. You're going to lose that evidence in the time it takes to get a warrant.
So there's a caretaking function once they get into that room, and then it stops.
Now well, it doesn't necessarily stop. In these particular facts, it appears that he was drunk and not injured. So it doesn't stop. But in this case, they attend.
It switches. Now we're switched into a different theory for making an arrest
getting evidence. It's like our plain view doctrine. If, you know, we analyze if an officer should be where he is, and then when he observes something, he observes something. But in this case, the reason they wouldn't get a warrant and would make the arrest right there is because of the dissipation of alcohol in the blood system. Mm-hmm. State v. Bowling speaks to that issue.
Has the United States Supreme Court departed from Katie versus Dombrowski?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and I have to say that I'm not aware if they have or have not. I know that our court in Pinker indicated clearly that it follows the federal standard when it comes to community caretaker, so I would assume that this court, in deciding Kramer and in reaffirming some of those opinions in Pinker, did not find a federal case in conflict with that.
In Katie versus Dombrowski, it did talk about the police may act in certain situations which are totally divorced from the detection, investigation, or acquisition of evidence relating to the violation of a criminal statute. Now, this court has stepped away from that very strict test. I kind of want to know how far we could go away from that.
And I agree, and I think that that reservation was expressed in Pinker. I would say that we look at the tests that we have created, both in Kramer and Pinker, and look at in each circumstance. And again, I would argue and submit that this is a stronger case than Pinker. It's not as strong as Kramer. Kramer is the poster child for community caretaker cases because it had everything in place. But I think it's stronger than Pinker, far stronger than Ulch, which was not good. And I think we see that the courts can understand this issue as to where to stop this doctrine. This doctrine cannot be used as an abusive attempt by the police to exploit the Fourth Amendment. It's not its purpose. That's why we have to be jealously guard when it's used. I think in this particular case, when you have a major traffic accident, consensual entry, and a brother smashing down the door, those are very, very unusual facts. But to imply that the doctrine here does not unduly extend it and certainly does not expand on Pinker or in any way compromise the Court of Appeals' opinion in Ulch.
You wouldn't have advised these officers once the brother smashed down the door to say to the brother, check him and see if he's okay so that they don't cross
him? The brother ran in. It was kind of a running in kind of scene.
So you call to the brother and say, hey, is he okay?
You know, I'm not even so sure what is different about that. The door is already open. They're seeing this person. His intoxication will be visible to the police officers. So at this point, you know, the breach has occurred when that door is smashed. I don't think it came down that way. There's screaming, there's yelling, there's door smashing. Surprise. Mm-hmm. It would have been different if the defendant had behaved in a manner more consistent with what you'd expect. I'm not putting the onus on the defendant, but something like, I'm okay, guys, from the closed door. I'm all right. Everything's fine. Like, go away, go away, go away.
But, you know, but he doesn't know why they're there. He doesn't know that they're there as caretakers and that they're really interested in his health. He doesn't know why the cops are there. For all we know, he thinks the cops are there to arrest him for some other offense that he's done or not. So to say he's got to respond, I'm okay, leave me alone, his response is, go away.
Again, the records, could they say he spoke in two languages? There was no real clarity of what was said at that time.
But there's no question he said go away, isn't it? Is there?
He said go away.
Go away.
To both his brother and to the police.
Right. In English? I mean, the law enforcement understanding was saying
there was no suggestion on the part of law enforcement as to any misunderstanding.
That they didn't understand, yeah. Well, you know, your whole portrayal of this, which makes sense, Mr. Perlman, is that when you start out with the reasonableness of caretaker because of the status of the car.
Yes.
Even without the blood. He could be internally bleeding, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
If you're seriously wounded.
Head injury, yeah.
Without any external blood. I saw that movie picture. So then they're reasonable in saying to the brother, can we come in? No, he invites them in. They're reasonable in going to the bedroom door. You're right. They did have error in trying the door. They should not have done that under these circumstances. That would have been, if they had opened that door, that would have been troublesome. Maybe it would have been defended under caretaker anyway, but you'd have a harder time. But everything they do, if you take the caretaker, is reasonable. But my problem still is, how far do you allow that to go? Suppose they had opened the door. Would you say that was okay under the caretaker?
Well, again, Chief, and I mean to beg the question that wasn't before us.
I know, I understand.
And I would say that that is harder to defend because there's something to me about this case and the brothers smashing the door, that to me almost puts I don't want to say all bets are off, but it puts a very unusual twist on what has occurred. But up till now, I still see a police department that was very sensitive to constitutional privacy needs. They didn't storm into that house like the cops did in Ulch, or even like they did in Pinkert. They got consent. Now, my light has turned yellow, too, and unless I'm not a good fortune teller, it seems like the first issue is of major concern to you, but
5 minutes.
I just want to address
briefly. You can move.
The second issue. Basically, on the second issue, the colloquy was deficient on the second classic requirement as to whether a person would be aware of the difficulties and disadvantages of self-representation, or put another way, would they be aware of the advantages of having a lawyer? I'd argue this is a pretty easy prong to meet. I would argue that it would have been nicer if he had explored the problem to court, but to compare this to the Deaver case, which counsel does in Deaver, which oddly is the same district that decided our case, in Deaver, court said, you want to go without counsel? Yes. Okay. That was it. By comparison to Deaver, we have a probing inquiry into what's going on here. He's asked about the financial ramifications. He's told now because you make $11.50 an hour, it'd be difficult for me to think you couldn't hire a lawyer, but you may feel that way. You could see you qualify for the appointment lawyer. If you don't qualify, one will come to you. And at the end, they finally reprise, at least for the moment, you plan to go ahead on your own. You haven't looked into hiring a lawyer. No, I haven't. What do we have here? We have a person who at the hearing said, I've seen lawyers' shows on television, familiarity with the O.J. Simpson trial. Knew a lawyer was helpful. He says if you were innocent, but I think that it's most people can appreciate. It's not a hard thing to know that lawyers are helpful, period. He was entering a plea without counsel, and he was doing so by negotiating with the prosecutor, and he was getting a recommendation for the minimum penalty. So in his mind, getting the minimum penalty here, he had a knowledge of what his implications were in this particular case, the likelihood that he could get off of on it, and went through a cost-benefit analysis. He was a high school graduate who had been admitted to a university to study engineering. Now, Gracia says his grades were bad, but he got admitted into college. So he's into college, he's in an engineering program, where my grades would be bad as well. It is not a stretch to infer that a person with this educational background would have a general understanding of the role an attorney plays in a criminal proceeding. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals so held. In summation, I just want to say that the state is sensitive to the community caretaker doctrine. We are sensitive to this court's concerns about its expansion. This was certainly made clear to us in Pinkert. I don't feel we're expanding Pinkert, but actually taking a case that's even stronger, because we're not using for justification to enter a house, only talking about the entry to a bedroom after a brother who I would say is concerned for his brother's safety, there's very little else to infer, smashes open the door with a police department that not only in testimony but in actions and in communications consistently and persistently discusses a safety concern as to the driver involved in that rather horrific crash.
I had one other question which will take you back to that first issue.
Yes.
If I am ill or injured and I don't want hospital or doctor care, you can't force it on me. So when he says go away, even if he's seriously injured, the police, there's a question whether they ought to be trying to help him.
Well, I think they have the right to make the contact with him and then determine in the course of that contact where they can actually make constructive recommendations to him as to what a doctor would do and everything else. And at that time, you're right, ultimately, if he doesn't want the treatment, he doesn't want the treatment, but I think the police should have that option to at least discuss with him, well, you're seriously injured, you're this, you're that.
So the caretaker function would be to
communicate
talk to him and see if he really is competent to say go away.
Ultimately.
Right. Okay.
Thank you, Justice.
Counsel, in rebuttal, you have 5 minutes.
I want to begin by clarifying a few things about the record, beginning to address actually Justice Bradley's question that was asked of Assistant Attorney General Perlman. The question about whether or not the police were ready to leave, I don't think actually is that up for grabs. The testimony from the record is that we were actually getting ready to clear. And at that point, a truck pulled up. So I don't think that really is in dispute. They were preparing to leave. Whether that makes a difference or not, this is for the court to decide, but that is certainly the case. Also, I wanted to make sure that it's clear that when they see that he's intoxicated, my reading of the record there is also that this all occurs after they've entered the bedroom already, not from the threshold. Again, whether that makes a substantial difference is for the court, but it is a factual difference that needs to be pointed out. I'd like to spend some time as well addressing the differences between this case, differences and similarities between this case and Pinkert and Ulch, since so much time was devoted to them by Attorney Perlman. I see three major differences between this case and Pinkert. First of all, there's no one awake in Pinkert. There's no one responsive in Pinkert. A great deal of the majority's opinion in Pinkert focuses on the fact that no one responds. We don't know what's going on with Mr. Pinkert or his female companion. We don't know if they've been the victim of a crime. We don't know if they have overdosed on the cocaine that's near where they're sleeping. Here we have someone who's up and, again, asking to be left alone or at least indicating that he wants to be left alone. There was also a good deal of discussion about the diminished expectation of privacy in Pinkert because we have an open door in Pinkert. Here we have two locked doors and a person saying, go away, repeatedly. The invocation of privacy is as clear as it could possibly have been, which I think, again, draws a clear line between this case and Pinkert. And finally, I think Pinkert, in an interesting way, goes back to the roots of community caretaker. In Katie V. Dombrowski, we're not concerned about Dombrowski's safety. He's involved in an accident, that's true, but he's already in the hospital. Instead, we're concerned about the public welfare. They're concerned that there might be a service weapon in Mr. Dombrowski or Officer Dombrowski's vehicle, and they want to search his vehicle so they can retrieve it and make sure that it doesn't fall into someone else's hands. There's an element of that in Pinkert, too, because, again, we have an open door and drugs in plain view once you're inside the house. So this idea that someone from the neighborhood could have wandered in, certainly Mr. Pinkert or his female companion could have been the victim of a crime, prospectively, that's really not an issue here at all either. So I think this case, instead of being, as was characterized by the state, instead of being a case where this is actually an easier call than Pinkard, I'd say not at all, and again, for those specific reasons. If we're to compare it to Ulch, which the state seems to have no objection with, that this was a properly decided case, we have cases that are incredibly similar. In both cases, we have an accident. We can use different adjectives to describe these accidents. We can use different adjectives to describe the level of damage to the vehicles in these accidents. I don't know if the law enforcement officers in this case took a creative writing class and are better with their adjectives than the officers in Ulch, but I can say that it sounds like the damage to Mr. Gracia's vehicle is slightly more severe than in Ulch. But the accident in Ulch is severe. Ms. Ulch drives into a house, pulls out of the house, and leaves the house in such bad shape that it's structurally unsound, or at least the people who reside there don't feel comfortable staying in the house. To say that somehow this is a less serious accident because we have a traffic light pulled down, I think, is a hard sell. There's also no indication of injury in either accident. There's a third party on the scene in both cases. In Ulch, the third party is ignored. Right? The police receive a statement from Ulch's boyfriend who says that Ms. Ulch is either asleep or in bed. They disregard that notion and enter anyway. Here, we have a third party who's really not utilized. They don't seek to inquire about Mr. Gracia's welfare through his brother or use his brother to do that for them. Instead, they think that they need to be the ones to do that, apparently, despite the fact that they never actually do it. Also, in both cases, I think we have evidence that someone's fine, and then it's ignored. In Ulch, it's from Ms. Ulch's boyfriend. In this case, it's actually from a more credible source. It's from the defendant himself. And there's never really an exploration of alternatives in either case. I'd say, again, there's this discussion that they obtained permission to enter the home. That's true. But once they get to the bedroom, there's no real exploration of possible alternatives, such as, again, asking Mr. Gracia how he's doing. And once the door is breached, that's also a possibility that's ignored. The Court of Appeals jokingly asked if the officers just was to cover their eyes and rely entirely on what Jaime Gracia has to offer. But that's not what happened here. Again, what they discover, they only discover after entering the bedroom, and they certainly could have asked him about his welfare prior to that. I see that my red light is on. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. On behalf of the court, I want to thank both attorneys for their argument once again in a Fourth Amendment case on search and seizures, this time on caretaker. And we appreciate both the briefs and the argument. That concludes our argument in 11AP 813 CR, 11AP 814, State versus Gracia. The court has concluded its oral arguments for the month of October, at least those that are scheduled. And so we will adjourn the oral arguments. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:10 in closed conference. We are adjourned.